Snap. There is absolutely no reason for me to be there. On Fisher Avenue, one night in Detroit, just a few months ago. No reason at all. My grandmother had passed away years ago, and any neighbors I had known had long since fled. The neighborhood looked completely different. Half the working class houses were missing. Missing in that they weren't there anymore. They're just empty lots. Like a pretty girl with big gaps where her teeth used to be. And searching the map of my memory, it took me a moment to be certain. But then I was sure. There it was. Leaning in on itself, tired at everything it had seen. My grandmother's house. Ground central from my childhood. The place where everything went down. The forts, the candy, the dancing, the gunshots, the food, the slide in the back, the scary basement. My grandfather's cigarettes. The ruins of everything. And I stood there staring at it like it meant something. Because it did mean something. We like to think that we've tamed our animal mind, but we too have instincts. Things we do, things we feel compelled to do, even when we're not sure why. Like a homing device. There's an urge that makes us want to go back, to revisit, to remember, to recollect. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present The Return. Amazing stories about going back. Get ready. Get ready for this one. You're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to start today's episode in one of the most remote places it is possible to be and still remain on the planet Earth. Step Judgment's Julia DeWitt has a story.
Out in the desert scrublands of northern South Africa, in a place called the Karoo, there is nothing. No trees, no water, for as far as you can see.
You're in a primeval landscape.
This is Don Shirley. Why he knows this place so well will become clear in a minute.
See a little rise. And when you get to the little hill, there's actually a big hollow there where the ground's collapsed. At the bottom of a very steep slope, you actually have a sheer face in front of you. And at the bottom of this sheer face is a puddle. So you think, oh, this is just a little puddle that doesn't go anywhere. But when you take the duckweed off the top, it's actually clear water.
Which means that this isn't just standing water. This water is filtering down to somewhere.
Now, if you go into this puddle, there's a small slot that goes through, which is just wide enough for a man's body to go through. After 20 foot, you're now starting to enter the cave. And gradually the cave gets wider.
Down below you is 900 feet of water. This is Bushman's Cave.
It's a huge cave. Now, if you take the Eiffel Tower and stand it on the floor of the Bushman's Cave, the top of the tower would be just about coming out the water.
The cave is almost 1,000 feet deep and about 2.5 football fields wide. The only thing that lives in the pitch darkness are these strange little blind white cave shrimp. Otherwise, the cave is dark, deep, and dead. This cave is a dangerous place for humans, and it's basically totally inaccessible to almost all of us. But for deep water divers, this is heaven. There are only a very few divers on the planet that have ever been anywhere near the bottom of this cave, and only about a dozen divers in the world ever dive to these kinds of depths, period. Don is one of these extreme divers. He met another of these deep water divers, a guy named Dave Shaw, back in 2002. They were immediately friends, and a couple of years later, Don took Dave to dive Bushmans. On dive day, they got to the puddle and Dave went in first. Dave swam down through the slot and the cave opened up below him. While he was going down, he was doing something called laying a shot line. Basically, he was just leaving a trail of rope. In the total darkness, this is the only way he knew how to get out of the cave.
You're in pitch black, absolute pitch black. So if you shine a light in any direction, it will disappear. The darkness will eat the light. Basically, being 900 foot in a cave, you might as well be on the moon. In fact, I think more people's walked on the moon than have actually been to those sort of depths in caves.
This sounds kind of unbelievable, but it's actually true. More people have walked on the moon than have been to the depth that Dave was diving at when he touched down on the floor of the cavern. Now, Dave was exploring on the bare floor of the cavern. There was nothing to see but his light in the black and the white rope that he dragged with him. Then, suddenly,
his torch caught the remains of D'Andrea.
No one knows exactly what happened to D'Andrea. But a decade earlier, Dion was diving with a team in Bushmans. When they stopped to take a head count, Dion was gone. People had been looking for his body ever since.
He was still in his wetsuit, still wearing his cylinders, collection of bones inside a wetsuit. And at the time, he tried to move the body, but the body was stuck in the silt. He was panting, and he said, I shouldn't work hard at this depth. It wasn't in the plan, so I needed to leave the body there.
Dion was 19 when he was lost in Bushmans, and dying while diving is kind of like dying in the line of duty for guys like Dave and Don.
He thought of it more of a mission to actually, yeah, his task to bring this body back.
So when Dave came up, he told Don he was going to come back and get Dion's body.
He phoned up Dion's parents and said, I'm going to retrieve your son's body.
The thing is that a dive like this is a major operation, so it took them almost a year to plan it.
You know, 900 foot under the water, there's a lot of risk involved in that. Every 33 foot that you go down effectively doubles the risk. You know, when you're down at those depths, anything that goes wrong is an issue.
Combining extreme depths with the hard work that Dave had to do to get Dion's body into a body bag came with a lot of risks. At depth, too much nitrogen is kind of like a narcotic. Basically, it feels suddenly like you drank 5 martinis in a row. Too much helium can give you twitching fits. If you breathe too heavily, like Dave might have to while he's moving around Dion's body, you pass out. And then, of course, there's the bends.
If you come up too quickly, it's like opening a Coke bottle once you've shook it up. It fizzes, and then you would have problems with bubbles in your blood.
To prevent the bends, Dave would take several hours to come up to the surface. So they recruited a team of support divers that would go into the water at intervals to check on Dave at various depths while he came up.
And the rule was, no one will go deeper than the depth where we actually plan for them to be.
Don would go the deepest.
But now, as far as Dave and I were concerned, basically what we said is, if Dave has a problem, he would signal me. And in caving, when you flash a light, you wave a light around, that's a distress signal. We got to the day that we're actually planning to do the main dive. And we went down early in the morning. It was still dark. The sun was not quite up yet. And at 6:15, Dave went under the water. I followed 14 minutes later.
Don followed the shot line down through the slot and into the cave.
So as I was going down, falling through this black space, I was expecting to see some rising bubbles as I was going down. Also, I would see Dave's light where he was coming back. When I was going down, I didn't actually see any bubbles coming back. What I did see, in the area where I thought he would actually be, I did see a light. It was one light, a solid light, just shining.
But the light wasn't moving.
Something's not quite right, and he's spending longer doing something. And then I knew that I would probably be going down to the bottom.
Don dove past 800 feet, deeper than he had ever been before.
Now, I went past my target depth, but the problem was, as I got to 833 foot, I actually had my own personal problems go on then.
He heard a sharp crack.
My rebreather controller actually imploded.
This just means a piece of his breathing apparatus broke, which actually wasn't a huge deal at this point. Don trained constantly for moments like this, so he knew exactly what to do. He would just add oxygen to his gas mixture manually.
But at that sort of depth, any oxygen that you add makes a hell of a difference, and I pushed my oxygen pressure much too high inadvertently. Now that's very unhealthy at that depth, very unhealthy. And I was liable to actually pass out very quickly.
Don knew then that this was it. It was the end of the line. He had to turn around and go back.
The surface is not somewhere that you can actually go to solve a problem. When you have a problem, you have to solve that problem there, where you are. And if you don't solve that problem, you don't come back. Yeah, I had to put the brakes on, as it were, at that point. And I was thinking, okay, Dave might come back. He's either dead or he's working his way back. But all I could deal with was what was in front of me.
Don knew that he now had over 10 hours in the water ahead of him. Don slowly ascended up to the roof of the cave. At this point, he started to pass out. And then he got a helium bubble in his ear.
And that made me lose balance completely. I'm over this extreme depth of water. You then have absolutely no sense of up, down, sideways or anything. And I didn't really have any sense of really where I was.
Don lost grip on the shot line, and as he was passing out, reviving again and passing out, he started swimming in these little circles, spinning around, looking for the line. Remember, this line is the only way Don knows how to get out of the cave.
And I'm in this void, the black. I had an extremely bright light in my hand, and where the light was going into the black, I was seeing black, and where the light was hitting the roof, I was seeing light, white, and then I'd keep spinning around like that, so I was seeing black, white, black, white, black, white. And then I caught the line, the white line, in my torch, and the next time I span round, I grabbed hold of the line. The trouble was now, I had vertigo, and that makes you vomit. Right, so now I was vomiting underwater as well, vomiting in between breaths, effectively. As time went on, I couldn't breathe anymore.
Don eventually stabilized himself, and he started his ascent again towards the surface. He met a support diver, and using a waterproof pencil and one of these slates the divers used to communicate underwater, Don wrote him a message.
I said, "I'm okay, and Dave's not coming back." But still in my mind, I had a hope that he would. From that point on, the guys had a task, which was to support me.
For hours, the team up above waited to see if he would make it out alive. His only job was to breathe. Dave's light down below had disappeared.
If you see the videos of me coming up, you'd think this guy's half dead. You know, it had been just over 12 hours in the water. I couldn't actually really do much for myself other than breathe. My head was like a marshmallow.
Don was put into a decompression chamber and then taken in the morning for more treatment at a hospital in Johannesburg. Dave did not come up that night. Dave was dead. And then a week later, Don got some news.
I actually was told that Dave's body had come up. Then it was a closure in the fact that, yeah, Dave's dead. But I knew he was dead before that, but that really started to put everything in its place, as it were. During that week, there'd been lots of speculation as to what had happened. Dave was carrying a camera on his head. In retrieving the camera, then we could piece together really what happened.
As the camera rolls, you see Dave trying to get Dion's body into a body bag.
One of his lights had actually got tangled up in the line and smashed. So now, bearing in mind you're in the pitch black, his main light had actually been broken, so he couldn't really see so well.
Then Dave also gets tangled. He pulls away, but now he's tied to Dion's body.
And you could see that he was working, trying to get himself out of this line. He was cutting with the scissors, but his scissors weren't even getting anywhere near the line.
Listening to the video, you can hear Dave's breathing start to get shallower and shallower as he starts working harder and harder.
Dave passed out from too much carbon dioxide. You know, he worked right up to the very last breath that he ever took, trying to get out. And then the camera just carries on recording until the batteries run out. It's like some sort of snuff tape. You know, it's actually, as Dave reaches his last breaths, it really is gut-wrenching, very sad. And it's not something you want to really listen to. There's barely a day goes by where I don't think of Dave. And a lot of times I turn around, I do a fantastic dive, and I just want to say, did you see that? And Dave very much did die nobly doing what he did. He did everything that he should do, and he died, as they'd say in the military, with his boots on. When Dave's body had come up, hanging underneath Dave's body, cocooned in the line that Dave originally had laid, was DeAndrea's body. So Dave actually achieved what he wanted to do.
Tremendous thanks to Don Shirley for sharing his world with The Snap. That piece, it was produced by Julia DeWitt. When Snap comes back, someone chases their mother to the end of the world. For real, when Snap Judgment, The Return, continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to The Snap. This is the return episode. Today, we're exploring the urge to go back in time, to go back in place, and to go back to the people that matter. We're going to travel to Venezuela, where an intrepid young anthropologist went in search of isolation and adventure, but he found something else entirely.
When David Good was a little boy, his mom wasn't around. So he had no mom at soccer practice or to help with homework.
But eventually people got curious. They wanted to find out, you know, where's your mom? And I told people that my mom died in a car crash.
The truth was she had left her family, her husband and her three kids, when David was 5 years old. And as he got older, he couldn't handle his anger.
You know, it got to a point where I realized that I can't keep going on like this, you know, hating myself on and on, you know, thinking, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? I'm going to hide from myself. That's pretty much how it culminated into that decision to go find my mom to reunite with her.
David, what was your biggest fear in going to find your mom?
My biggest fear? Getting shot with a bow and arrow. I was afraid I was going to get caught in a raid or something. And you hear all these stories and getting shocked by electric eels or getting attacked by a jaguar. I had a lot of fears to think about.
David's mom is a member of the Yanomami tribe. See, David's dad, Ken Good, is an anthropologist. And in 1975, he traveled by canoe through the rapids of the Orinoco River in Venezuela, deep into the Amazon jungle, trying to find the Yanomami people.
The Yanomami they're very, very basic in the way they live. They have no clothes. They only count to two. They have no musical instruments. They're just living in a state of nature in the Amazon forest.
Ken's teacher, Napoleon Chagnon, had written about the Yanomami, describing them as fierce and prone to war and violence. After days of traveling by canoe and on foot, Ken finally met the Yanomami on the banks of the river. He didn't speak any Yanomami.
I pulled up in my outboard canoe, and of course they hear the outboard motor for a mile away, and they came running down. And they were all there and exciting, and they were just there looking and chatting and talking to me and Yanomami. They have no idea. They had no idea there are other languages. They call me Akaborebu, which means ghost tongue. They would stand outside my hut through look through the palm slats and laugh, and everything about me was funny. I take my socks off and they laughed because my toes were squeezed together from wearing shoes since I was two, and theirs were more splayed for never wearing shoes.
He was supposed to stay with the Yanomami for 15 months, but he started to learn the language. He moved into their communal home. He ended up staying for 12 years.
It was just so nice to be there, and I felt so good and happy. There was nothing to ask for.
After a few years, some local men had something to ask of him. They wanted him to kind of join their family.
One day, the headman of the village, he came to me and he says, you can't stay here all the time without having a wife. So I just laughed, you know. He kept insisting that I take his younger sister. And I don't know how old she was. I'm guessing she was about 12 or 13. Now, betrothed is what happens when you simply say, she's going to be your wife someday. It's sort of like a promise. I said, you know, no, I can't do that, you know, no. And so the headman was insisting, her older brother, and he was quite a strong-willed guy. So I said, okay, all right, she's my wife.
Ken figured it was purely a ceremonial engagement, a formality until he went back home.
I figured I'll go home whenever I do, and that'll be the end of that.
So the girl's name was Yadima, and he would go with her family on trips into the jungle.
We had fun. We used to go hunting and gathering out on the trail, and I was so caring about her in every little regard. If she got a cut on her toe or something, and everything, just really. And I realized I was thinking about her all the time.
Their relationship developed over the course of many years. This is what Yadima said about that time. as transcribed by Ken. At dawn and dusk, I thought about Kenny. I remembered how he would carry me on his back. She said, I brought food to his hammock and he would always smile. She talked about missing him terribly when he would go away.
You know, as to how can a PhD candidate from a Western culture marry an Amazonian native woman who has never been out of the jungle and thought the whole world was an Amazon jungle? I couldn't conceptualize it. That's the way it went, but things changed. It was totally unexpected. Sometimes emotions are difficult to describe. I just fell in love with her.
I asked Ken what the age difference was between them when they made their marriage official.
I don't like to talk about it, and you're the first interview I've done in almost 20 years. Why should I have to talk about when I consummated my marriage?
He says he believes she was about 15 or 16 when they first consummated their marriage. He's taken a lot of criticism for this over the years. Ken, what's the criticism that bothered you the most?
That she was a little girl. That I had married a little girl. And it was an abuse. These people only lived to be about 45 or so. The 15-year-old girl in their culture is not the same as a 15-year-old. A 15-year-old here is totally immature. She's a little kid still. She's probably chewing gum at the mall. And in Yanomami culture, she's a woman. She's a full-fledged woman. She's doing all of women's chores, and she's probably pregnant or has a baby. Now you say, well, that's them, you know. What do you know? They're Indians. Well, I'm sorry. This all occurred within the confines of their communal structure.
Ken had lived in their world for many years, but he was supposed to be there as a professional anthropologist, and his choice was a problem for other anthropologists.
You study these people, but you don't get involved with them and marry them. I said, why not? I said, they're human beings like any other people on Earth.
Still, there's a lot that's complicated about their marriage, not just for anthropologists. Even in the village, Ken and Yadima had a lot of problems. When Ken had to leave to deal with his visa or paperwork, the others would think he had left forever, and Yadima became fair game. She was mistreated. But for the most part, it worked. They lived together, they hunted together, and at night they slept together in Ken's hammock. And before long, they became pregnant with their first son, David.
You know, I do remember playing in the creeks, you know, walking around in the plantain gardens with the kids, practicing archery, shooting lizards, you know, with the boys and trying to fine-tune our hunting skills.
David doesn't remember too much else, because he was actually raised in New Jersey. Ken got too worried about Yadima's safety in the village.
My father had asked my mom, you know, why don't you come to my people, come to my village of New Jersey, where we can always be together, and then, you know, I don't have to be afraid for you for being alone in the jungle, and she agreed.
So that's what they did. They moved from Hasapuateri, Venezuela, to New Jersey.
So you could imagine that a woman that lived in the jungle her whole life, and now she's went through a time machine, fast forward like 2,000 years, and in a different cosmos, different world.
We just had a little fun. I flipped the switch off and on, and that just was amazing. It's dark, and it's light, and it's dark as light.
She had seen a full-length mirror for the first time, and she freaked out, and she, you know, hid behind a bed. My dad had to cover up the mirror, you know.
Somebody started up a Jeep, and she went crazy. I didn't see her, but I had to go find her in the bushes because she thought it was an animal.
And my father once caught my mom just strolling outside without any clothes on, and he comes, you know, covers her up, tries to tell her, and, you know, in my world, you gotta wear clothes all the time.
But there were bigger problems, too. For the first time, Yadima was spending a lot of the day alone. Ken was out working, teaching at a nearby college.
The man that my father was down in the jungle, you know, it's not the same man that he was up here in New Jersey, and he's working hard to try to pay the bills and keep the food on the table. Of course, my mom has no concept of that. She doesn't know why he's gone all the time.
The thing about living here is nothing made sense. In Yanomami culture, the most important things to them are their family, and not just their kids or their parents, but their extended family. And so she was cut off from that. But you got to understand what it was for her. And I didn't like it. I didn't bring her back here to make her a little American housewife, for God's sake.
They had 3 kids in New Jersey, and all of them would go back together to the village in Venezuela for long visits. David and his brother and sister learned to hunt and how to speak the language. And once, Ken and Yarima went back alone, and Yarima said she wanted to stay. She and Ken went back and forth about it, but when the plane came to the airstrip to take them to New Jersey, Yarima actually fled into the jungle. Ken was worried about the kids, so he boarded the plane, figuring he'd come back for Yarima later. But he never did.
And then there was sort of like this realization that set in that, wow, you know, mom's gone, and, you know, she's not coming back.
Suddenly, we became a family of 4. 3 kids and me, and I was a single father.
As I, you know, got older, I sort of went through this phase where I just didn't want it to be known as a Yanomama, and I don't ever want to hear that word, and I never want to, you know, hear about mom again, and I don't want to be associated with that culture and that tribe. I just wanted to be this typical American kid growing up, you know. I played baseball, I was a paper boy. It's embarrassing. All of my friends' moms are picking them up at, you know, soccer practice or driving them to baseball practice, but my mom is, you know, naked in the jungle eating tarantulas.
Of course, all his dad's pictures were in museums and in textbooks, because Ken was a leading anthropologist on the Yanomami.
In elementary school, we had this periodical that would come out called Scholastic Journal for Kids. You know, there was one on my desk, and I flipped through the page, and bam, there's a huge picture of me and my uncle in the village in the Amazon, and the caption underneath says, you know, Yanomama boy learning how to shoot a bow and arrow with a relative. And I just started sweating bullets, because I'm like, oh my gosh, everyone in my class is going to find out. And for the next, you know, 15 to 20 years, it just kept festering inside me, and it kept getting worse and worse. And I did, you know, turn to alcohol to cope with, you know, a lot of my problems, and actually dropped out of high school. So I knew that if I had to, you know, survive for the rest of my life, I'm going to have to cope with this. I read my dad's book, and you know, I got to understand some of the struggles that my mom had when she was up here. And so I had this innate yearning to go, you know, to want to go find her.
So David bought a 1-way ticket to Venezuela.
It's pretty neat to think that I'm taking the same trip that my father took decades ago. And I remember starting, you know, feeling a little tense, a little anxious that we're getting closer and closer. And when the motor's revving, villagers can hear it from a mile away, and it's sort of there's this excitement because they don't get visitors too often, and they scream, motor, motor, and they all start running to the riverbank to see who's coming. We pulled up, introduced ourselves, and they said that I was David, the son of Yarima, and I'm here to go to find her. And so the villagers of Hasa Pugateri, they said, come out of the boat, we wanna see you, and we wanna touch you. And so I was completely mobbed with Yanomama. I had hands all over my body. They were pulling my ear, touching my nose, touching my hair, and that's when my mom finally arrived. I saw her walk in, and she was carrying a basket, and the whole village was immediately quiet, and it was hushed, and people were whispering, and I can hear them whispering Yarima's name. And I stood up, and I approached her, and I realized, how do I greet her? What's the Yanomami way of greeting when you don't see somebody for 20 years? And I know that they don't hug or anything, and just sort of this awkward moment at first where everything in me just wanted to hug her and hold her, but I didn't want to make the moment awkward for her either. And as we got closer, she just started trembling and crying, and I can remember her hand shaking, and she was touching me almost as if to see if I was even real. And I told her, you know, I made it. It's been so long, but I made it. I looked into her eyes, and she just started crying, and then out of nowhere, I just started getting flooded with all these memories of being with her when I was 5. My mother's alive, and I found her, and we're together, and now I want to develop this relationship and friendship with her.
He wanted to stay for a long time. He didn't know exactly how long, but he hung up his hammock and settled in.
As the months went by, she started remembering some English, and one time I was sitting in my hammock and she comes up to me and says, "Hey, do you want some snake?" Just pure, perfect English. And I'm looking at her like, where did that come from? You know? You know, she was very patient with me and she knew that, you know, that I lived in the world of the Naba, of the outsider, and that, you know, I have much to learn.
David, this isn't the soccer mom relationship that you wanted as a kid.
No, definitely not. But, you know, not too many mothers can go out there and kill a boa constrictor for you and come back.
Pretty soon after his arrival, David was offered the same opportunity as his dad.
I was introduced to two girls in the village. So I asked, who are these girls? And my mom replied, "Oh, these are my wives." And, you know,
David's wives.
My wives, you know, they're two girls. And so I thought a wife was going to be like a sister or a brother. But I was wrong. They really, really wanted to be my wife. And they really wanted me to be their husband. And it became evident after I spent some time in the village that they really, really wanted to have kids. And in their mind, they're probably thinking, you know, his father is a Naba, a complete outsider, and he took a Yanomami wife. Surely his son, who is half Yanomami, would have no problem taking a Yanomami wife. It's just that I grew up in America, and there's this huge cultural barrier where I couldn't be their husband. I couldn't be that Yanomami husband. And it actually turned into some conflicts where a couple times at night I had to kick my wife out of the hammock. And then there's times where they ganged up on me saying, you know, "You're my Yanomami husband and we're going to have children together and don't be afraid." And that's what my mom would say a lot was, you know, "Don't be afraid, it's okay, they're your wives." Because every time they would get close to me, I'd start getting nervous and like, okay.
It made him wonder, how did his dad manage to do it, to cross this divide that felt so wide? So he arranged for a boat downstream to a nearby mission, where they had a generator, where they had a satellite internet connection.
So I sat my mom down and in front of the computer and I Skyped my dad.
You know, I'm sitting there, all of a sudden I'm on Skype and I'm talking to him and he moves over and there's his mother. I said, "Oh my, I couldn't believe it." He didn't tell me. A little secretive, this guy, but he did, you know. And there I am for the first time in 20 years looking at my wife.
And they just started Skyping each other in Yanomami.
I was amazed. She still looked so great, and she had the sticks in her mouth that young girls live in. I start talking Yanomami first time in 20 years, and I realized I didn't forget it. That was amazing. She looked at me, and she said, "Are you married?" And I said, "No." And I looked at her, and I said, "Are you married?" And she said, "No." And then we just kind of sat there and looked at each other for about 15 seconds, and then boom, it was, I said, "No." because people think, you still love her. You should go down there and get her. She's waiting for you.
As I was watching them interact and talk to each other, it just, you know, really hit me that they just seemed to get along so well, the way they just interacted. And I knew right then and there that why they fell in love, you know, because they just felt so natural together.
What was his motivation? Why did he want me to see and talk to his mother? Was he hoping we'd get back together? I don't know. But that's the only reason. What do you think? I still love her and should go get her down there?
I think you still love her. But I don't think you should go down there and get her. I think you tried that.
Yeah.
We've got huge appreciation for Kenneth Good and his son David for sharing their story with SNAP. David Good is now doing remarkable work with the Yanomami. Check out Project Good on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with assistance from Beth Morgan and sound design by Renzo Gorio. That was tight, right? Well, when Snap Judgment comes back, we're chasing a whooping. Yep. When the return episode returns, stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the return episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're returning back to the scene of the event to see if maybe we can make our peace. Our next storyteller, Josh Cherugino, performs all over the place, but this story was recorded live at the Busting Out Storytelling event in the San Francisco Bay. Josh Cherugino, take it away.
This is a story about a car and a friendship. It's June, 2 months before my 16th birthday, and I'm in a plane flying into the Burbank airport.
My older brother Todd and I are flying back from our grandmother's funeral. My brother is my guardian on the flight, which is highly ironic, because to him, I'm a skinny punching bag and a Led Zeppelin t-shirt.
He's got me by 3 years, 60 pounds, he's a weightlifter, and his in-flight entertainment consists of gripping me in a headlock, peppering me with a few rabbit punches, and smashing my face into the window. So while I'm looking, gazing down at the sprawl of Los Angeles, I notice we're flying over a car lot, and through the heat shimmer, I see row upon row of blue and white police cruisers and some orange Dodge Chargers with rebel flags painted on the roof, the Confederate flag. These are the cars used on the infamous Dukes of Hazzard TV show, driven by the Duke boys, Bo and Luke. It's a ridiculous show, and basically all they do is they go terrassing around Hazzard County, having adventures and outwitting the police and righting wrongs and terrassing around Hazzard County in an orange Dodge Charger. And I don't care about the show.
I care about getting out of the headlock and breathing again.
And I know Todd will care, because this summer, the summer of his 18th year, he wants one thing, a fast and powerful car.
And so I squeak, and he looks out the window, and he sees the cars, and the bells go off, and he punches the wall, which he's apt to do, and shouts, "Yeehaw," which is what the Duke boys say when they're excited about punching walls.
And the next day, he drags me out to the set where they film the Dukes of Hazzard, and we meet the guy in charge of all the cars used on the show. He's the car wrangler, and it turns out they've got some for sale. We look at a couple of the pristine A cars they use in all the shots, and then we take a test drive in a B car, a stunt car. This thing is painted like jet black. It was a 1976. I don't know how big the motor was. Three on the tree, V8, dual carbs, just a monster. It's kind of banged up, but it's loud and it's fast. We haul ass all over that country set. We get it up to 110 miles an hour on the freeway. He even lets me drive, which is a bit generous considering our relationship. And he says, "Look, I'm short $500. Loan it to me. I'll pay you back in the fall. Meanwhile, we can work on the car together, and I'll let you drive it." And I say, "Yeah." And we get the car, and you know, we start to work on it. There's things like the windshield wipers that want to come on and off when they want to. We do the shocks and the struts, and there's the problem with the heater. You can't turn it on because it sticks, and it'll compromise the electrical system, but it's the middle of the hottest summer on record. We leave that for the fall. Todd warms up to me this summer. We'd never been close. He was hostile to me from the day I came home from the hospital at 4 months of age, having had a brain surgery. He tipped my crib over, spilling me onto the floor, and the child psychologist that my parents sent him to said he hates his little brother. Yeah. So basically, we have this car together, and we're sharing it, and finally, he opened up to me. He talked to me about our parents' divorce and his feelings of anger around it. He asked me about my feelings. He shared his favorite hobbies with me, taught me to play guitar and how to talk to girls. And he retired his favorite hobby, which was 2-3 beatings a week and, you know, an object of all his verbal and physical aggression. Now, he was still the archetypal, you know, poster child for the angry young man syndrome, but now it was easygoing and it was fun. And one night after this greasy meal at Carl's Jr., he was instructing me in the finer points of maneuvering a Dodge Charger around a high school football track. And again, this is a couple hundred, this is like a couple tons of prime American steel. And as I'm, you know, damaging my high school property, a car comes through the parking lot. It's a police car. They're so close, I can see the donut crumbs in the mustache of this Ventura County sheriff. And he spots me. He lights up the Christmas tree, hits the siren, and before he can turn around, I've gone out the other side of the field, like 0 to 60 in the blink of an eye. And we haul ass. He wants me to drive, and I said, shut up, I'm the Duke boy, blah, blah, blah. And we juke and we drive and we lose the cops and we're screaming, just like the brothers on the show. We get home, he punches me in the shoulder and he looks at me. He's proud of me at last.
My 16th birthday, August 2nd, a couple of weeks later. He lets me take the car out solo for the first time, and I pick up my girlfriend, Katya. We're going out for a birthday dinner, and it's the hottest day of the summer. It's literally 109 degrees. She goes to turn on the AC, but moves the heater lever by mistake, and I can't turn it off. So it's really boiling now. But we just roll down the windows and drive faster.
We have a great time. I drop her off. And as I'm driving home, the car starts to overheat. It's boiling, steam's coming out from under the hood. But I'm almost there, and so I keep going. As I get up the hill, it sputters and it dies. Just one house down from ours. And somehow Todd knows this, and he comes charging out of the house. And when he sees the car, when he sees his baby dead in the street, steam comes out of his ears. And he grabs me, and he says, I told you not, it's for the heater, blah, blah, blah. Like, he's not even making words, but he knows what's going on. And right then, he punches me in the solar plexus, right? But not this time, not anymore. I've grown over the summer. Ironically, he's taught me, and I'm not doing this again. And so I stand there, and I wind up, and as hard as I can, I throw a right cross onto the bridge of his nose, and his head rocks back, and he touches the blood gushing out of what is a broken nose, and he looks at me with a mixture of shock and a little bit of fear and respect. And I think, I've done it. I've slayed the dragon. We turn the corner, and he'll respect me from this day forward. And he kicks my ass across the street. And when I say he kicks my ass across the street, it was like a cartoon brawl with the dust cloud. Down the lawn, through the hedge, sidewalk, blacktop. I'm getting up and knocked down again. Through the median, more blacktop. And finally, he's coming in for the coup de grace. And I freeze, and I'm looking behind him. And he catches my eye, and he turns. And we both watch the car burn. It's consumed by orange fire. You can see the black paint melting away. And as that car goes up in smoke, our friendship and our brotherhood go with it.
Todd bought a motorcycle and moved out at the end of the summer. We're cordial now, even friendly sometimes. But we were never as tight again as we were that summer when we were as tight as them Duke boys.
Thank you.
Josh Cherugino. He's a storyteller from L.A., a three-time MOP Grand Slam winner. And this piece was produced by K.D. Martini and Mark Ristich. It's that time. And you're thinking, Not now. I need more snap. But we understand. So get the podcast, full episodes, movies, pictures, stuff at snapjudgment.org. Yes, Snap Judgment is on the Facebook, Twitter, snapjudgment.org. The Snap is produced by myself and the rowdiest range of returnees the world has ever known. Please say hello and goodbye to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He can dance too. Pat Massini Miller, Anna Sussman returns Christmas presents for cash. Stephanie Fu has a no return policy. Julia DeWitt can wear a cowboy hat and boots unironically. Wenzel Gorio cannot. Nick Vanderkolk doesn't return library books. And Will Urbina returns to the scene of his crime. The Snap production crew, Nicholas Lafredo, Yasmin DaCosta, Beth Borgen, and Mood Zadie. Have you ever taken the hand of a sleeping person and placed it in a bowl of warm water? Well, never do that to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, because this type of stunt is a matter of grave public health and will not be tolerated, and whatever else they said. But much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, is a place where a person can go to exchange their old radios for one that's shiny and new. I don't know how they make any money with that, but to find out more, go to prx.org. Now, you know this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could return the cup of sugar you borrowed back to the neighbors, only to discover that they left the front door unlocked, allowing you to borrow their new sofa, their grandmother's jewelry box, and their riding lawnmower. And when the police want to ask you a few questions about your neighborly borrowing, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.